there. He's wearing a tie, and he hasn't touched it. And that woman with the tightly buttoned collar. Burton was beginning to regain his composure now. After the initial shock of the town, he was beginning to think clearly. They walked up to the van, standing in the middle of the street, its lights still shining weakly. Stone reached in to turn off the lights. He pushed the stiff body of the driver back from the wheel and read the name on the breast pocket of the parka. Sean. The man sitting rigidly in the back of the van was a private named Crane. Both men were locked in rigor mortis. Stone nodded to the equipment in the back. "Will that still work?"
I think so,
Burton said. "Then let's find the satellite. That's our first job. We can worry later about..." He stopped. He was looking at the face of Sean, who had obviously pitched forward hard under the steering wheel at the moment of death. There was a large, arc-shaped cut across his face, shattering the bridge of his nose and tearing the skin. "I don't get it," Stone said.
"Get what?"
Burton said. "This injury. Look at it."
"Very clean," Burton said. "Remarkably clean, in fact. Practically no bleeding."
Then Burton realized. He started to scratch his head in astonishment, but his hand was stopped by the plastic helmet.
"A cut like that," he said, "on the face. Broken capillaries, shattered bone, torn scalp, veins. It should bleed like hell."
"Yes," Stone said. "It should. And look at the other bodies, even where the vultures have chewed at the flesh. No bleeding." Burton stared with increasing astonishment. None of the bodies had lost even a drop of blood. He wondered why they had not noticed it before.
"Maybe the mechanism of action of this disease..."
"Yes," Stone said. I think you may be right." He grunted and dragged Sean out of the van, working to pull the stiff body from behind the wheel. "Let's get that damn satellite," he said. "This is really beginning to worry me." Burton went to the back and pulled Crane out through the rear doors, then climbed in as Stone turned the ignition. The starter turned over sluggishly, and the engine did not catch. Stone tried to start the van for several seconds, then said,
"I don't understand. The battery is low, but it should still be enough."
"How's your gas?" Burton said. There was a pause, and Stone swore loudly. Burton smiled and crawled out of the back. Together, they walked up the street to the gas station, found a bucket, and filled it with gas from the pump after spending several moments trying to decide how it worked. When they had the gas, they returned to the van, filled the tank, and Stone tried again. The engine caught and held. Stone grinned.
"Let's go."
Burton scrambled into the back, turned on the electronic equipment, and started the antenna rotating. He heard the faint beeping of the satellite.
"The signal's weak, but still there. Sounds over to, the left somewhere."
Stone put the van in gear. They rumbled off, swerving around the bodies in the street. The beeping grew louder. They continued down the main street, past the gas station and the general store. The beeping suddenly grew faint.
"We've gone too far. Turn around."
It took a while for Stone to find reverse on the gear shift, and then they doubled back, tracing the intensity of the sound. It was another 15 minutes before they were able to locate the origin of the beeps to the north on the outskirts of the town. Finally, they pulled up before a plain, single-story, wood-frame house. A sign creaked in the wind. Dr. Alan Benedict.
"Might have known," Stone said. "They take it to the doctor."
The two men climbed out of the van and went up to the house. The front door was open, banging in the breeze. They entered the living room and found it empty. Turning right, they came to the doctor's office. Benedict was there, a pudgy, white-haired man. He was seated before his desk, with several textbooks laid open. Along one wall were bottles, syringes, pictures of his family, and several others showing men in combat uniforms. One showed a group of grinning soldiers. The scrawled words, "For Benny, from the boys of 87, Anzio." Benedict himself was staring blankly toward a corner of the room, his eyes wide, his face peaceful.
"Well," Burton said, "Benedict certainly didn't make it outside."
And then they saw the satellite. It was upright, a sleek, polished cone 3 feet high, and its edges had been cracked and seared from the heat of re-entry. It had been opened crudely, apparently with the help of a pair of pliers and chisel that lay on the floor next to the capsule. "The bastard opened it," Stone said. "Stupid son of a bitch."
"How was he to know?"
"He might have asked somebody," Stone said. He sighed. "Anyway, he knows now, and so do 49 other people." He bent over the satellite and closed the gaping triangular hatch. "You have the container?" Burton produced the folded plastic bag and opened it out. Together they slipped it over the satellite, then sealed it shut.
"I hope to hell there's something left," Burton said.
"In a way," Stone said softly,
"I hope there isn't."
They turned their attention to Benedict. Stone went over to him and shook him. The man fell rigidly from his chair onto the floor. Burton noticed the elbows and suddenly became excited. He leaned over the body.
"Come on," he said to Stone. "Help me."
"Do what?"
"Strip him down."
"Why?"
"I want to check the lividity."
"But why?"
"Just wait," Burton said.
He began unbuttoning Benedict's shirt and loosening his trousers. The two men worked silently for some moments, until the doctor's body was naked on the floor.
"There," Burton said, standing back.
"I'll be damned," Stone said. There was no dependent lividity. Normally, after a person died, blood seeped to the lowest points, drawn down by gravity. A person who died in bed had a purple back from accumulated blood. But Benedict, who had died sitting up, had no blood in the tissue of his buttocks or thighs, or in his elbows, which had rested on the arms of the chair.
"Quite a peculiar finding," Burton said.
He glanced around the room and found a small autoclave for sterilizing instruments. Opening it, he removed a scalpel. He fitted it with a blade, carefully, so as not to puncture his airtight suit, and then turned back to the body.
"We'll take the most superficial major artery and vein," he said.
"Which is?"
"The radial, at the wrist."
Holding the scalpel carefully, Burton drew the blade along the skin of the inner wrist, just behind the thumb. The skin pulled back from the wound, which was completely bloodless. He exposed fat and subcutaneous tissue. There was no bleeding.
"Amazing."
He cut deeper. There was still no bleeding from the incision. Suddenly, abruptly, he struck a vessel. Crumbling, red-black material fell out onto the floor.
"I'll be damned," Stone said again. "Clotted solid," Burton said.
"No wonder the people didn't bleed." Burton said,
"Help me turn him over."
Together they got the corpse onto its back, and Burton made a deep incision into the medial thigh, cutting down to the femoral artery and vein. Again, there was no bleeding. And when they reached the artery, as thick as a man's finger, it was clotted into a firm, reddish mass.
"Incredible."
He began another incision, this time into the chest. He exposed the ribs, then searched Dr. Benedict's office for a very sharp knife. He wanted an osteotome, but could find none. He settled for the chisel that had been used to open the capsule. Using this, he broke away several ribs to expose the lungs and the heart. Again, there was no bleeding. Burton took a deep breath, then cut open the heart, slicing into the left ventricle. The interior was filled with red, spongy material. There was no liquid blood at all.
Clotted solid, he said. No question.
Any idea what can clot people this way?
The whole vascular system? 5 quarts of blood? No.
Burton sat heavily in the doctor's chair and stared at the body he had just cut open.
I've never heard of anything like it.
There's a thing called disseminated intravascular coagulation, but it's rare and requires all sorts of special circumstances to initiate it. Could a single toxin initiate it?
In theory, I suppose, but in fact, there isn't a toxin in the world.
He stopped. Yes, Stone said. I suppose that's right. He picked up the satellite designated Scoop 7 and carried it outside to the van. When he came back, he said, We'd better search the houses.
Beginning here?
Might as well, Stone said. It was Burton who found Mrs. Benedict. She was a pleasant-looking, middle-aged lady, sitting in a chair with a book on her lap. She seemed about to turn the page. Burton examined her briefly, then heard Stone call to him. He walked to the other end of the house. Stone was in a small bedroom, bent over the body of a young teenage boy on the bed. It was obviously his room. Psychedelic posters on the walls, model airplanes on a shelf to one side. The boy lay on his back in bed, eyes open, staring at the ceiling. His mouth was open. In one hand, an empty tube of model airplane cement was tightly clenched. All over the bed were empty bottles of airplane dope, paint thinner, terps. Stone stepped back. Have a look. Burton looked in the mouth, reached a finger in, touched the now hardened mass.
Good God, he said.
Stone was frowning. This took time, he said. Regardless of what made him do it, it took time. We've obviously been oversimplifying events here. Everyone did not die instantaneously. Some people died in their homes, some got out into the street, and this kid here... He shook his head. Let's check the other houses. On the way out, Burton returned to the doctor's office, stepping around the body of the physician. It gave him a strange feeling to see the wrist and leg sliced open, the chest exposed, but no bleeding. There was something wild and inhuman about that, as if bleeding were a sign of humanity. Well, he thought, perhaps it is. Perhaps the fact that we bleed to death makes us human. For Stone, Piedmont was a puzzle challenging him to crack its secret. He was convinced that the town could tell him everything about the nature of the disease, its course and effects. It was only a matter of putting together the data in the proper way. But he had to admit, as they continued their search, that the data were confusing. A house that contained a man, his wife, and their young daughter, all sitting around the dinner table. They had apparently been relaxed and happy, and none of them had had time to push back their chairs from the table. They remained frozen in attitudes of congeniality, smiling at each other across the plates of now rotting food and flies. Stone noticed the flies, which buzzed softly in the room. He would, he thought, have to remember the flies. An old woman, her hair white, her face creased. She was smiling gently as she swung from a noose tied to a ceiling rafter. The rope creaked as it rubbed against the wood of the rafter. At her feet was an envelope, in a careful, neat, unhurried hand, to whom it may concern. Stone opened the letter and read it. The day of judgment is at hand. The earth and the waters shall open up, and mankind shall be consumed. May God have mercy on my soul, and upon those who have shown mercy to me. To hell with the others. Amen.
Burton listened as the letter was read. Crazy old lady, he said. Senile dementia. She saw everyone around her dying, and she... well, she went nuts.
And killed herself?
Yes, I think so.
Pretty bizarre way to kill yourself, don't you think?
The kid also chose a bizarre way,
Burton said.
Stone nodded.
Roy O. Thompson, who lived alone. From his greasy coveralls, they assumed he ran the town gas station. Roy had apparently filled his bathtub with water, then knelt down, stuck his head in, and held it there until he died. When they found him, his body was rigid, holding himself under the surface of the water. There was no one else around, and no sign of struggle.
Impossible, Stone said. No one can commit suicide that way.
Lydia Everett, a seamstress in the town, who had quietly gone out to the backyard, sat in a chair, poured gasoline over herself, and struck a match. Next to the remains of her body, they found the scorched gasoline can. William Arnold, a man of 60, sitting stiffly in a chair in the living room, wearing his World War I uniform. He had been a captain in that war, and he'd become a captain again, briefly, before he shot himself through the right temple with a Colt 45. There was no blood in the room when they found him. He appeared almost ludicrous, sitting there with a clean, dry hole in his head. A tape recorder stood alongside him, his left hand resting on the case. Burton looked at Stone questioningly, then turned it on.
A quavering, irritable voice spoke to them. You took your sweet time coming, didn't you? Still, I'm glad you've arrived at last. We are in need of reinforcements. I tell you, it's been one hell of a battle against the Hun. Lost 40% last night, going over the top, and two of our officers are out with the rot. Not going well, not at all. If only Gary Cooper was here. We need men like that, the men who made America strong. I can't tell you how much it means to me, with those giants out there and the flying saucers. Now they're burning us down, and the gas is coming. You can see them die, and we don't have gas masks, none at all. But I won't wait for it. I'm going to do the proper thing now. I regret that I have but one life to kill for my country.
The tape ran on, but it was silent. Burton turned it off.
Crazy, he said. Stark, raving mad.
Stone nodded.
Some of them died instantly, and the others went quietly nuts.
But we seem to come back to the same basic question. Why? What was the difference?
Perhaps there's a graded immunity to this bug, Burton said. Some people are more susceptible than others. Some people are protected, at least for a time.
You know, Stone said, there was that report from the flybys and those films of a man alive down here, one man in white robes.
You think he's still alive?
Well, I wonder, Stone said. Because if some people survived longer than others, long enough to dictate a taped speech or to arrange a hanging, then you have to ask yourself if someone maybe didn't survive for a very long time. You have to ask yourself if there isn't someone in this town who is still alive. It was then that they heard the sound of crying. At first, it seemed like the sound of the wind. It was so high and thin and reedy. But they listened, feeling puzzled at first, and then astonished. The crying persisted, interrupted by little hacking coughs. They ran outside. It was faint and difficult to localize. They ran up the street,
and it seemed to grow louder. This spurred them on. And then, abruptly, the sound stopped. The two men came to a halt, gasping for breath, chests heaving. They stood in the middle of the hot, deserted street and looked at each other.
"Have we lost our minds?" Burton said.
"No," Stone said. "We heard it all right." They waited. It was absolutely quiet for several minutes. Burton looked down the street at the houses and the Jeep van parked at the other end, in front of Dr. Benedict's house. The crying began again, very loud now, a frustrated howl. The two men ran. It was not far, two houses up on the right side. A man and a woman lay outside on the sidewalk, fallen and clutching their chests. They ran past them and into the house. The crying was still louder. It filled the empty rooms. They hurried upstairs, clambering up, and came to the bedroom. A large double bed, unmade. A dresser. A mirror. A closet. And a small crib. They leaned over, pulling back the blankets, from a small, very red-faced, very unhappy infant. That baby immediately stopped crying long enough to survey their faces and closed in the plastic suits. Then it began to howl again.
"Scared the hell out of it," Burton said. "Poor thing."
He picked it up gingerly and rocked it. The baby continued to scream. Its toothless mouth was wide open, its cheeks purple, and the veins stood out on his forehead.
"Probably hungry," Burton said.
Stone was frowning.
"It's not very old. Can't be more than a couple of months. Is it a he or a she?"
Burton unwrapped the blankets and checked the diapers.
"He. And he needs to be changed. And fed."
He looked around the room.
"There's probably some formula in the kitchen."
"Nope," Stone said. "We don't feed it."
"Why not?"
"We don't do anything to that child until we get it out of this town. Maybe feeding is part of the disease process. Maybe the people who weren't hit so hard or so fast were the ones who hadn't eaten recently. Maybe there's something protective about this baby's diet. Maybe..." He stopped. "But whatever it is, we can't take a chance. We've got to wait and get him into a controlled situation." Burton sighed. He knew that Stone was right, but he also knew that the baby hadn't been fed for at least 12 hours. No wonder the kid was crying. Stone said, "This is a very important development. It's a major break for us, and we've got to protect it. I think we should go back immediately."
"We haven't finished our headcount."
Stone shook his head. "Doesn't matter. We have something much more valuable than anything we could hope to find. We have a survivor." The baby stopped crying for a moment, stuck its finger in its mouth, and looked questioningly up at Burton. Then, when he was certain no food was forthcoming, he began to howl again.
"Too bad," Burton said. "He can't tell us what happened."
"I'm hoping he can," Stone said. They parked the van in the center of the main street, beneath the hovering helicopter, and signaled for it to descend with a ladder. Burton held the infant, and Stone held the scoop satellite. Strange trophies, Stone thought, from a very strange town. The baby was quiet now. He had finally tired of crying and was sleeping fitfully, awakening at intervals to whimper, then sleep again. The helicopter descended, spinning up swirls of dust. Burton wrapped the blankets about the baby's face to protect him. The ladder came down, and he climbed up with difficulty. Stone waited on the ground, standing with a capsule in the wind and dust and thumpy noise from the helicopter. And suddenly, he realized that he was not alone on the street. He turned and saw a man behind him. He was an old man, with thin gray hair and a wrinkled, worn face. He wore a long nightgown that was smudged with dirt and yellowed with dust, and his feet were bare. He stumbled and tottered toward Stone. His chest was heaving with exertion beneath the nightgown.
"Who are you?"
Stone said, but he knew. The man in the pictures. The one who had been photographed by the airplane.
"You,"
the man said.
"Who are you?" You did it.
What is your name?
Don't hurt me. I'm not like the others.
He was shaking with fear as he stared at Stone in his plastic suit. Stone thought, we must look strange to him, like men from Mars, men from another world.
Don't hurt me.
We won't hurt you, Stone said. What is your name?
Jackson. Peter Jackson, sir. Please don't hurt me.
He waved to the bodies in the street.
I'm not like the others.
We won't hurt you, Stone said again.
You hurt the others.
No, we didn't.
They're dead.
We had nothing.
You're lying, he shouted,
his eyes wide.
You're lying to me. You're not human. You're only pretending. You know I'm a sick man. You know you can pretend with me. I'm a sick man. I'm bleeding. I know. I've had this.
He faltered and then doubled over, clutching his stomach and wincing in pain. Are you all right? The man fell to the ground. He was breathing heavily, his skin pale. There was sweat on his face.
My stomach, he gasped. Yeah, is my stomach.
And then he vomited. It came up heavy, deep red, rich with blood. Mr. Jackson. But the man was not awake. His eyes were closed, and he was lying on his back. For a moment, Stone thought he was dead, but then he saw the chest moving slowly, very slowly, but moving. Burton came back down. Who is he? Our wandering man. Help me get him up.
Is he alive?
So far. I'll be damned, Burton said. They used the power winch to hoist up the unconscious body of Peter Jackson, and then lowered it again to raise the capsule. Then, slowly, Burton and Stone climbed the ladder into the belly of the helicopter. They did not remove their suits, but instead clipped on a second bottle of oxygen to give them another 2 hours of breathing time. That would be sufficient to carry them to the wildfire installation. The pilot established a radio connection to Vandenberg so that Stone could talk with Major Manchek.
What have we found?
Manchek said. The town is dead. We have good evidence for an unusual process at work.
Be careful, Manchek said. This is an open circuit.
I am aware of that. Will you order up a 712?
I'll try. You want it now?
Yes, now.
Piedmont?
Yes.
You have the satellite?
Yes, we have it.
All right, Manchek said. I'll put through the order.
8. Directive 712. Directive 712 was a part of the final wildfire protocol for action in the event of a biologic emergency. It called for the placement of a limited thermonuclear weapon at the site of exposure of terrestrial life to exogenous organisms. The code for the directive was cautery, since the function of the bomb was to cauterize the infection, to burn it out, and thus prevent its spread. As a single step in the wildfire protocol, cautery had been agreed upon by the authorities involved, executive, state, defense, and AEC, after much debate. The AEC, already unhappy about the assignment of a nuclear device to the wildfire laboratory, did not wish cautery to be accepted as a program. State and defense argued that any above-ground thermonuclear detonation, for whatever purpose, would have serious repercussions internationally. The president finally agreed to Directive 712, but insisted that he retain control over the decision to use a bomb for cautery. Stone was displeased with this arrangement, but he was forced to accept it. The president had been under considerable pressure to reject the whole idea, and had compromised only after much argument. Then, too, there was the Hudson Institute study. The Hudson Institute had been contracted to study possible consequences of cautery. Their report indicated that the president would face four circumstances, scenarios, in which he might have to issue the cautery order. According to degree of seriousness, The scenarios were 1. A satellite or manned capsule lands in an unpopulated area of the United States. The president may cauterize the area with little domestic uproar and small loss of life. The Russians may be privately informed of the reasons for breaking the Moscow Treaty of 1963, forbidding above-ground nuclear testing. 2. A satellite or manned capsule lands in a major American city. The example was Chicago. The cautery will require destruction of a large land area and a large population, with great domestic consequences and secondary international consequences. 3. A satellite or manned capsule lands in a major neutralist urban center. New Delhi was the example. The cautery will entail American intervention with nuclear weapons to prevent further spread of disease. According to the scenarios, there were 17 possible consequences of American-Soviet interaction following the destruction of New Delhi. 12 led directly to thermonuclear war. 4. A satellite or manned capsule lands in a major Soviet urban center. The example was Stalingrad. Cautery will require the United States to inform the Soviet Union of what has happened and to advise that the Russians themselves destroy the city. According to the Hudson Institute scenario, there were 6 possible consequences of American-Russian interaction following this event, and all 6 led directly to war. It was therefore advised that if a satellite fell within Soviet or Eastern Bloc territory, the United States not inform the Russians of what had happened. The basis of this decision was a prediction that a Russian plague would kill between 2 and 5 million people, while combined Soviet-American losses from a thermonuclear exchange involving both first and second strike capabilities would come to more than 250 million persons. As a result of the Hudson Institute report, the president and his advisors felt that control of cautery and responsibility for it should remain within political, not scientific, hands. The ultimate consequences of the president's decision could not, of course, have been predicted at the time it was made. Washington came to a decision within an hour of Manchek's report. The reasoning behind the president's decision has never been clear, but the final result was plain enough. The president elected to postpone calling Directive 712 for 24 to 48 hours. Instead, he called out the National Guard and cordoned off the area around Piedmont for a radius of 100 miles. And he waited. 9. Flat Rock. Mark William Hall, M.D., sat in the tight rear seat of the F-104 fighter and stared over the top of the rubber oxygen mask at the file on his knees. Levitt had given it to him just before takeoff, a heavy, thick wad of paper bound in gray cardboard. Hall was supposed to read it during the flight, but the F-104 was not made for reading. There was barely enough room in front of him to hold his hands clenched together, let alone open a file and read. Yet Hall was reading it. On the cover of the file was stenciled "Wildfire," and underneath, an ominous note. "This file is classified top secret. Examination by unauthorized persons is a criminal offense punishable by fines and imprisonment up to 20 years and $20,000. When Levitt gave him the file, Hall had read the note and whistled.
"Don't you believe it," Levitt said.
"Just a scare?"
"Scare hell," Levitt said. "If the wrong man reads this file, he just disappears."
"Nice.
Read it," Levitt said, "and you'll see why."
The plane flight had taken an hour and 40 minutes, cruising in eerie, perfect silence at 1.8 times the speed of sound. Hall had skimmed through most of the file. Reading it, he had found, was impossible. Much of its bulk of 274 pages consisted of cross-references and inter-service notations, none of which he could understand. The first page was as bad as any of them. "This is page 1 of 274 pages. Project Wildfire. Authority, NASA, AMC. Classification, top secret. NTK basis. Priority, national. DX. Subject, initiation of high security facility to prevent dispersion of toxic extraterrestrial agents. Crossfile, Project Clean. Project Zero Contaminants. Project Cautery. Summary of file contents. By executive order, construction of a facility initiated January 1965. Planning stage, March 1965. Consultants Fort Detrick and General Dynamics, EBD, July 1965. Recommendation for multi-story facility, an isolated location for investigation of possible or probable contaminatory agents. Specifications reviewed August 1965. Approval with revision, same date. Final drafts drawn and filed AMC under Wildfire. Copies Dietrich, Hawkins. Choice of site, Northeast Montana. Reviewed August 1965. Choice of site, Southwest Arizona. Reviewed August 1965. Choice of site, Northwest Nevada. Reviewed September 1965. Nevada site, approved October 1965. Construction completed July 1966. Funding, NASA, AMC, Defense, Unaccountable Reserves. Congressional appropriation for maintenance and personnel under same. Major alterations. Millipore filters. See page 74. Self-destruct capacity. Nuclear. Page 88. Ultraviolet irradiators removed. See page 81. Single man hypothesis. Odd man hypothesis. Page 255. Personnel summaries have been eliminated from this file. Personnel may be found in AMC Wildfire files only. The second page listed the basic parameters of the system, as laid down by the original Wildfire Planning Group. This specified the most important concept of the installation, namely, that it would consist of roughly similar descending levels, all underground. Each would be more sterile than the one above. This is page 2 of 274 pages. Project Wildfire. Primary parameters. 1. There are to be 5 stages. Stage 1. Non-decontaminated, but clean. Approximate sterility of hospital operating room or NASA clean room. No time delay of entrance. Stage 2. Minimal sterilization procedures. Hexachlorophene and methanol bath, not requiring total immersion. 1 hour delay with clothing change. Stage 3. Moderate sterilization procedures. Total immersion bath, UV irradiation, followed by 2 hour delay for preliminary testing. A febrile infections of UR and GU tracts permitted to pass. Viral symptomology permitted to pass. Stage 4. Maximal sterilization procedures. Total immersion in 4 baths of biocaine, monochlorophen, xantholysin, and prophene with intermediate 30-minute UV and IR irradiation. All infection halted at this stage on basis of symptomology or clinical signs. Routine screening of all personnel. 6-hour delay. Stage 5. Redundant sterilization procedures. No further immersions or testing, but destruct clothing times 2 per day. Prophylactic antibiotics for 48 hours. Daily screen for superinfection, first 8 days. 2. Each stage includes 1. Resting quarters, individual. 2. Recreation quarters, including movie and game room. 3. Cafeteria, automatic. 4. Library, with main journals transmitted by Xerox or TV from main library, level 1. 5. Shelter, a high-security antimicrobial complex with safety in event of level contamination. 6. Laboratories. A. Biochemistry, with all necessary equipment for automatic amino acid analysis, sequence determination, OR potentials, lipid and carbohydrate determinations on human, animal, other subjects. B. Pathology, with EM, Phase and LM, microtomes and curing rooms. 5 full-time technicians each level. 1 autopsy room. 1 room for experimental animals. C. Microbiology, with all facilities for growth, nutrient, analytic, immunologic studies. Subsections, bacterial, viral, parasitic, other. D. Pharmacology, with material for dose relation and receptor site specificity studies of known compounds. Pharmacy to include drugs as noted in appendix. E. Main room, experimental animals. 75 genetically pure strains of mice, 27 of rat, 17 of cat, 12 of dog, 8 of primate. F. Non-specific room for previously unplanned experiments. 7. Surgery, for care and treatment of staff, including operating room facilities for acute emergencies. 8. Communications, for contact with other levels by audiovisual and other means. Count your pages. Report any missing pages at once. Count your pages. As Hall continued to read, he found that only on level 1, the topmost floor, would there be a large computer complex for data analysis, but that this computer would serve all other levels on a time-sharing basis. This was considered feasible since, for biologic problems, real time was unimportant in relation to computer time, and multiple problems could be fed and handled at once. He was leafing through the rest of the file, looking for the part that interested him, the odd man hypothesis, when he came upon a page that was rather unusual. This is page 255 of 274 pages. By the authority of the Department of Defense, this page from a high-security file has been deleted. The page is number 255. The file is coded Wildfire. The subject matter deleted is Odd Man Hypothesis. Please note that this constitutes a legal deletion from the file which need not be reported by the reader. Machine score review below. Hall was frowning at the page, wondering what it meant, when the pilot said,
Dr. Hall?
Yes?
We have just passed the last checkpoint, sir. We will touch down in 4 minutes.
All right. Hall paused. Do you know where exactly we are landing?
I believe, said the pilot, that it is Flat Rock, Nevada.
I see, Hall said. A few minutes later, the flaps went down, and he heard a whine as the airplane slowed. Nevada was the ideal site for wildfire. The Silver State ranks 7th in size, but 49th in population. It is the least dense state in the Union after Alaska, particularly when one considers that 85% of the state's 440,000 people live in Las Vegas, Reno, or Carson City. The population density of 1.2 persons per square mile seems well suited for projects such as wildfire, and indeed many have been located there. Along with the famous atomic site at Vinton Flats, there is the Ultra Energy Test Station at Martindale, and the Air Force Medevator Unit near Los Gatos. Most of these facilities are in the southern triangle of the state, having been located there in the days before Las Vegas swelled to receive 20 million visitors a year. More recently, government test stations have been located in the northwest corner of Nevada, which is still relatively isolated. Pentagon classified lists include 5 new installations in that area. The nature of each is unknown. 10. Stage 1. Hall landed shortly after noon, the hottest part of the day. The sun beat down from a pale, cloudless sky, and the airfield asphalt was soft under his feet as he walked from the airplane to the small Quonset hut at the edge of the runway. Feeling his feet sink into the surface, Hall thought that the airfield must have been designed primarily for night use. At night, it would be cold, the asphalt solid. The Quonset hut was cooled by two massive, grumbling air conditioners. It was furnished sparsely. A card table in one corner, at which two pilots sat, playing poker and drinking coffee. A guard in the corner was making a telephone call. He had a machine gun slung over his shoulder. He did not look up as Hall entered. There was a coffee machine near the telephone. Hall went over with his pilot, and they each poured a cup. Hall took a sip and said, "Where's the town, anyway? I didn't see it as we were coming in."
"Don't know, sir."
"Have you been here before?"
"No, sir."
"It's not on the standard runs."
"Well, what exactly does this airfield serve?"
At that moment, Levitt strode in and beckoned to Hall. The bacteriologist led him through the back of the Quonset and then out into the heat again to a light blue Falcon sedan parked in the rear. There were no identifying marks of any kind on the car. There was no driver. Levitt slipped behind the wheel and motioned for Hall to get in. As Levitt put the car in gear, Hall said,
"I guess we don't rate anymore."
"Oh, yes, we rate. But drivers aren't used out here. In fact, we don't use any more personnel than we have to. The number of wagging tongues is kept to a minimum."
They set off across desolate, hilly countryside. In the distance were blue mountains shimmering in the liquid heat of the desert. The road was pockmarked and dusty. It looked as if it hadn't been used for years. Hall mentioned this.
"Deceptive," Levitt said. "We took great pains about it. We spent nearly $5,000 on this road."
"Why?" Levitt shrugged.
"Had to get rid of the tractor tread marks. A hell of a lot of heavy equipment has moved over these roads at one time or another. Wouldn't want anyone to wonder why."
"Speaking of caution," Hall said after a pause, "I was reading the file. Something about an atomic self-destruct device."
What about it?"
"It exists?"
"It exists."
Installation of the device had been a major stumbling block in the early plans for Wildfire. Stone and the others had insisted that they retain control over the detonate, no detonate decision. The AEC and the executive branch had been reluctant. No atomic device had been put in private hands before. Stone argued that in the event of a leak in the Wildfire lab, there might not be time to consult with Washington and get a presidential detonate order. It was a long time before the president agreed that this might be true.
"I was reading," Hall said, "that this device is somehow connected with the odd man hypothesis."
"It is."
"How?"
"The page on odd man was taken from my file."
"I know," Levitt said. "We'll talk about it later."
The Falcon turned off the potted road onto a dirt track. The sedan raised a heavy cloud of dust, and despite the heat, they were forced to roll up the windows. Hall lit a cigarette.
"That will be your last," Levitt said.
"I know. Let me enjoy it."
On their right, they passed a sign that said, "Government property, keep off." But there was no fence, no guard, no dogs. Just a battered, weather-beaten sign.
"Great security measures," Hall said.
"We try not to arouse suspicion. The security is better than it looks."
They proceeded another mile, bouncing along the dirt rut, and then came over a hill. Suddenly, Hall saw a large, fenced circle, perhaps 100 yards in diameter. The fence, he noticed, was 10 feet high and sturdy. At intervals, it was laced with barbed wire. Inside was a utilitarian wooden building and a field of corn.
"Corn?"
Hall said. "Rather clever, I think."
They came to the entrance gate. A man in dungarees and a T-shirt came out and opened it for them. He held a sandwich in one hand and was chewing vigorously as he unlocked the gate. He winked and smiled and waved them through, still chewing. The sign by the gate said, "Government property, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Desert Reclamation Test Station. Levitt drove through the gates and parked by the wooden building. He left the keys on the dashboard and got out. Hall followed him. Now what?
Inside, Levitt said.
They entered the building, coming directly into a small room. A man in a Stetson hat, check sport shirt, and string tie sat at a rickety desk. He was reading a newspaper and, like the man at the gate, eating his lunch. He looked up and smiled pleasantly.
Howdy, he said. Hello, Levitt said. Help you folks? Just passing through, Levitt said. On the way to Rome.
The man nodded. Have you got the time?
My watch stopped yesterday, Levitt said.
Turn shame, the man said.
It's because of the heat.
The ritual completed, the man nodded again, and they walked past him out of the anteroom and down a corridor. The doors had hand-printed labels, seedling incubation, moisture control, soil analysis. A half-dozen people were at work in the building, all of them dressed casually, but all of them apparently busy.
This is a real agricultural station, Levitt said. If necessary, that man at the desk could give you a guided tour, explaining the purpose of the station and the experiments that are going on. Mostly, they are attempting to develop a strain of corn that can grow in low moisture, high alkalinity soil.
And the wildfire installation?
Here, Levitt said.
He opened a door marked storage, and they found themselves staring at a narrow cubicle lined with rakes and hose and watering hoses.
Step in, Levitt said.
Hall did. Levitt followed and closed the door behind him. Hall felt the floor sink, and they began to descend, rakes and hoses and all. In a moment, he found himself in a modern, bare room lighted by banks of cold, overhead fluorescent lights. The walls were painted red. The only object in the room was a rectangular, waist-high box that reminded Hall of a podium. It had a glowing green glass top.
Step up to the analyzer, Levitt said. Place your hands flat on the glass, palms down.
Hall did. He felt a faint tingling in his fingers, and then the machine gave a buzz.
All right. Step back.
Levitt placed his hands on the box, waited for the buzz, and then said,
Now, we go over here. You mentioned the security arrangements. I'll show them to you before we enter wildfire.
He nodded to a door across the room.
What was that thing? Finger and palm print analyzer. Levitt said. It's fully automatic, reads a composite of 10,000 dermatographic lines so it can't make a mistake. In its storage banks, it has a record of the prints of everyone cleared to enter wildfire.
Levitt pushed through the door. They were faced with another door, marked security, which slid back noiselessly. They entered a darkened room in which a single man sat before banks of green dials.
Hello, John, Levitt said to the man. How are you?
Good, Dr. Levitt. Saw you come in.
Levitt introduced Hall to the security man, who then demonstrated the equipment to Hall.
There were, the man explained, two radar scanners located in the hills overlooking the installation. They were well concealed, but quite effective. Then closer in, impedance sensors were buried in the ground. They signaled the approach of any animal life, weighing more than 100 pounds. The sensors ringed the base.
We've never missed anything yet, the man said.
And if we do, he shrugged. To Levitt. Gonna show him the dogs?
Yes, Levitt said.
They walked through into an adjoining room. There were 9 large cages there, and the room smelled strongly of animals. Hall found himself looking at 9 of the largest German shepherds he had ever seen. They barked at him as he entered, but there was no sound in the room.
He watched in astonishment as they opened their mouths and threw their heads forward in a barking motion. No sound. "These are army-trained sentry dogs," the security man said, "bred for viciousness. You wear leather clothes and heavy gloves when you walk them. They've undergone laryngectomies, which is why you can't hear them, silent and vicious." Hall said, "Have you ever, used them?" "Nope," the security man said. "Fortunately not." They were in a small room with lockers. Hall found one with his name on it.
"We change in here," Levitt said.
He nodded to a stack of pink uniforms in one corner.
"Put those on after you've removed everything you're wearing."
Hall changed quickly. The uniforms were loose-fitting, one-piece suits that zipped up the side. When they had changed, they proceeded down a passageway. Suddenly an alarm sounded, and a gate in front of them slid closed abruptly. Overhead, a white light began to flash. Hall was confused, and it was only much later that he remembered Levitt looked away from the flashing light.
"Oh, something's wrong," Levitt said. "Did you remove everything?"
"Yes," Hall said.
"Rings, watch, everything?"
Hall looked at his hands. He still had his watch on.
"Go back," Levitt said. "Put it in your locker."
Hall did. When he came back, they started down the corridor a second time. The gate remained open, and there was no alarm. "Automatic as well?" Hall said.
"Yes," Levitt said. "It picks up any foreign object. When we installed it, we were worried because we knew it would pick up glass eyes, cardiac pacemakers, false teeth, anything at all. But fortunately, nobody on the project has these things."
"Fillings?"
"It's programmed to ignore fillings."
"How does it work?"
"Some kind of capacitance phenomenon. I don't really understand it," Levitt said.
They passed a sign that said, "You are now entering level 1. Proceed directly to immunization control." Hall noticed that all the walls were red. He mentioned this to Levitt.
"Yes," Levitt said. "All levels are painted a different color. Level 1 is red, 2 yellow, 3 white, 4 green, and 5 blue."
"Any particular reason for the choice?"
"It seems," Levitt said, "that the Navy sponsored some studies a few years back on the psychological effects of colored environments. Those studies have been applied here."
They came to immunization. A door slid back, revealing 3 glass booths. Levitt said,
"Just to sit down in one of them."
"I suppose this is automatic, too?"
"Of course."
Hall entered a booth and closed the door behind him. There was a couch and a mass of complex equipment. In front of the couch was a television screen, which showed several lighted points. "Sit down," said a flat mechanical voice. "Sit down. Sit down." He sat on the couch. "Observe the screen before you. Place your body on the couch so that all points are obliterated." He looked at the screen. He now saw that the points were arranged in the shape of a man. He shifted his body, and one by one, the spots disappeared. "Very good," said the voice. "We may now proceed. State your name for the record. Last name first. First name last." "Mark Hall," he said. "State your name for the record. Last name first. First name last." Simultaneously on the screen appeared the words, "Subject has given uncodable response. Hall, Mark. Thank you for your cooperation," said the voice. "Please recite. Mary had a little lamb."
"You're kidding," Hall said.
There was a pause, and the faint sound of relays and circuits clicking. The screen again showed, "Subject has given uncodable response. Please recite." Feeling rather foolish, Hall said, Mary had a little lamb, her fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. Another pause. Then the voice.